content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah.com. All right, this first article is called Why Gender Reveal Parties Should Have Been Canceled Long Before the California Wildfires. The family who announced the sex of their baby with an explosion of color at California's El Dorado Ranch Park didn't mean to start the fire that's since driven 21,000 people from their homes. They tried to put it out with water bottles, fire investigators told CNN, but 3 days later, the growing blaze was only 16% contained. There's no time to consider why on earth anyone would intentionally cause a spark outdoors during what was already predicted to be a rough California wildfire season, because so many other questions that preceded this tragedy remain. Why do people insist on gender reveal stunts? And why is there a fixation on gender reveals in general? Even the woman credited with popularizing the trend has said time and again that she deeply regrets it. With so many things to celebrate about an impending bundle of joy, it's long past time to shelve the gender reveal party trend. They're problematic for many reasons, including the preventable disasters that are making headlines right now. Here's what you should know. In 2017, an Arizona off-duty U.S. Customs and Border Patrol protection agent named Dennis Dickey fired a gun into a target packed with explosive material called Tannerite. In the video, the target is visibly surrounded by dry brush. The resulting fire spread into the Coronado National Forest and a mix of state, federal, and private land, burning up nearly 47,000 acres and causing $8 million in property damage, to say nothing of the environmental consequences. It's a boy! Dickey ultimately agreed to 5 years probation, plus paying $200,000 in damages. It's not yet clear whether the family that started the El Dorado fire will be held responsible in any way. But these aren't the only two gender reveals that led to fire. In April 2020, another Tannerite target demolished 12 acres of Florida forest before it was contained. More calls to reconsider this trend came after an October 2019 disaster when an excited grandmother-to-be was killed by shrapnel lodged in her head. Her Iowa family accidentally created a pipe bomb with their homemade gunpowder-filled contraption. It was meant to discharge Instagrammable streaks of colored powder, but instead it sent metal chunks flying. The grandmother died instantly on the scene. The blogger who started this trend shared her creative celebration of Bianca, her baby-to-be, in 2008 by throwing a party in which she cut open a cake to reveal its pink insides. The viral blog post set a trend that continues to this day, but she really wishes that was not the case. Not just because the stunts have gotten so out of hand, but because of a potentially toxic subtext to a party that hinges on the idea that a person's gender defines them before they've even entered the world. This crystallized for her when her now 11-year-old made her realize that firsthand. "Plot twist," she wrote on Facebook in 2019. "The world's first gender reveal party baby is a girl who wears suits." The problem is, they overemphasize one aspect of a person, she says. And she reveals she never had another gender reveal party for her other two children. She went on to explain how another daughter of hers helped teach her that lesson. On Christmas morning when she was 3, she opened up a set of Legos in primary colors and started crying. She said, "Santa Claus brought me a boy toy." She thought because they weren't pink, they weren't for her, she wrote. That's when I was like, you know what? Something has to change. There's such an obsession with gender that it becomes limiting in many ways and exploitative in others. You don't want what's between your legs to guide your path in life. I want my kids to grow up in a world where gender doesn't matter. News of the El Dorado wildfire has since made her a bit more blunt. "Stop it. Stop. Stop having these stupid parties. Oh, for the love of God, stop burning things down to tell everyone about your kid's penis. No one cares but you." Gone are the days when a mere cake with pink insides would garner enough likes to create an online sensation. Now people arrange for planes to dump a wash of revelatory color. One crashed in Texas in 2019. Or, in a viral video that brought mixed reactions, place a watermelon filled with dye into the mouth of a hippopotamus. At least the hippo is okay. Yes, it is about celebrating exciting news with loved ones. But would they be so elaborate if they weren't meant to be shared online? There's this huge pressure to publicize these once private moments, Carly Geisler, an associate professor at the City University of New York's York College, who studied the phenomenon, told USA Today in 2019. You get that outside validation that what you did was unique, that it was special. It drives celebrations to the extreme because you're trying to do the thing that no one has ever done before. A person or a couple who's been trying for a baby of a certain sex for years is completely allowed to be excited about their news, and wanting to celebrate that major event is understandable. But let's say that that baby who was born a girl grows up to realize that they identify as transgender. Will they be embraced or punished and shunned by their family for not fulfilling the expectations established with that first plume of pink smoke? Fun fact, the pink and blue colors assigned to gender were wholly a creation of American retail manufacturers from the 1940s onward. Like many gender conventions, the shades were completely made up and then just rarely questioned. According to a Human Rights Campaign Foundation report, anti-transgender stigma, denial of opportunity, and increased risk of factors compound to create a culture of violence. What begins with a lack of family acceptance can result in sexual assault, homelessness, or even murder. In fact, at least 21 trans or gender nonconforming people have been killed in the first 7 months of 2020, in part due to transphobia, the most since the HRC began tracking it in 2013. Gender reveal parties are obviously not the direct cause of a spike in trans violence. But before you light that blue powder-filled cannon, it's good to know how you'd react if your child one day told you they are not in fact a boy. The mom who's worried about the pink triangles on her baby son's crib sheet is a very far cry from the person who kills another human over their perceived gender transgressions, but they do share one thing in common: a strong belief that gender comes with rules to be followed. Some expectant parents may feel that a baby shower simply isn't enough revelry, particularly if they had previously been grappling with infertility or the pregnancy was preceded by miscarriage. Absolutely no one is saying that you can't have 10 or more parties for your fetus that have nothing to do with its genitals. When you don't care what your baby's gender is, as my partner and myself didn't when I was pregnant, it actually feels deeply weird when so many people around you suddenly need to know your baby's sex. As my belly grew, the deluge of obsessed comments did too, until all of the questions and declarations like, what's the gender? And you didn't find out? Oh my gosh, I go crazy. And how will you plan the nursery if you don't know? Began to sound sweaty and creepy. Eventually, does it have a penis or vagina down there? Tell me, I've got to know, is all we heard whenever family members and various strangers leaned in and started up with their fixation on a topic that we were not remotely interested in. So I made up my own answer to the unending, do you know what you're having? A healthy human baby, I would say, because that's all we most want in the end. All right, this next article is called Barack Obama Tells Oprah He Was Thrilled Joe Biden Won the Presidency. When the election was finally called and Joe Biden was declared the 46th president of the United States, former President Barack Obama took to Twitter to congratulate his former VP. I could not be prouder, he wrote. Now, as part of an interview with Oprah on The Oprah Conversation, which premiered November 17th, Obama elaborated on his reaction to Biden and future Vice President Kamala Harris's victory and what it means for the future of our country. I was thrilled, he told Oprah. Joe is somebody who stood by me on every major decision I had for 8 years. He's become a brother and a genuinely good friend. Kamala was one of my earliest supporters when I first launched my presidency. I'm personally invested in them. They have the character and experience to do an outstanding job in a very difficult, very challenging time in this country, Obama continued. The 44th president also expressed his hope that Biden and Harris's election would usher in the restoration of a different, less incendiary tone of politics in this country. Beyond the personal investment I have in them, I think this gives us a chance to get back to the kind of competent, caring government that we so badly need and the world expects out of the United States of America, he said. Obama's interview on the Oprah Conversation will be free to watch on Apple TV Plus through December 1st and available for subscribers after that date. The interview coincides with the publication of Obama's new memoir, A Promised Land, which covers the events of his 8 years in the White House. While speaking to Oprah, Obama also opened up about some of the most challenging events he faced as president, like the tragic Sandy Hook shooting in 2009. On December 14, 2012, an armed gunman claimed the lives of 26 people, 20 children and 6 adults, employees of the school. The following year, Congress defeated an ambitious gun control bill that would have banned the sale of assault weapons, like the one used in the Sandy Hook Elementary, per the Washington Post. That was not only the saddest day of my presidency, but when Congress failed to do anything in the aftermath of Sandy Hook, that was the angriest I ever was in my presidency. I was disgusted and appalled by the inaction, Obama said. The former president is the latest in a series of guests on the Oprah Conversation, an Apple series Oprah launched earlier this year. Each installment features illuminating discussions with thought leaders and luminaries about the issues that affect us all. Past guests have included singers Mariah Carey and Stevie Wonder, actor Matthew McConaughey, and Professor Ibram X. Kendi. All right, and now I'm going to share some Kamala Harris quotes that will inspire you to take charge. Anyone who claims to be a leader must speak like a leader. That means speaking with integrity and truth. Kamala's mother would say to her, "Kamala, you may be the first to do many things, but make sure you are not the last," Harris said. That's why breaking those barriers is worth it. As much as anything else, it's also to create that path for those who will come after us. "Imperfect though we may be, I believe we are a great country," Harris, the daughter of two immigrant parents, said during her first speech on the Senate floor. "And part of what makes us great are our democratic institutions that protect our fundamental ideals, freedom of religion and the rule of law, protection from discrimination based on national origin, freedom of the press, and a 200-year history as a nation built by immigrants." On voting, she says, "To everyone keeping up the fight, you are doing something. You are the reason I know we're going to bring our country closer to realizing its great promise. But to do it, we'll need to work, organize, and vote like never before, because we need more than a victory. We need a mandate that proves that the past few years do not represent who we are or who we aspire to be." On fighting injustice, she says, "At every step of the way, I have been guided by the words I spoke from the first time I stood in a courtroom. Kamala Harris, for the people," she said during her vice presidential acceptance speech at the DNC. "I've fought for children and survivors of sexual assault. I've fought against transnational gangs. I took on the biggest banks and helped take down one of the biggest for-profit colleges. I know a predator when I see one." On race and racism, she says, "Let's speak the truth. People are protesting because Black people have been treated as less than human in America. Because our country has never fully addressed the systemic racism that has plagued our country since its earliest days. It is the duty of every American to fix it. No longer can some wait on the sidelines hoping for incremental change. In times like this, silence is complicity," she wrote. On her parents' influence, "My parents would bring me to protest, strapped tightly in my stroller, and my mother, Shamla, raised my sister Maya and me to believe that it was up to us and every generation of Americans to keep on marching. She'd tell us, 'Don't sit around and complain about things, do something.' So I did something. I devoted my life to making real the words carved in the United States Supreme Court: equal justice under law." On the Black maternal health crisis, she says, "Every day pregnant women walk into their doctor's office for checkups, advice, and treatment. But that experience is very different for Black women. Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely than white women to die from pregnancy-related causes, and twice as likely to suffer from life-threatening pregnancy-related complications. On ambition, Kamala says, "There will be people who say to you, 'You're out of your lane,'" Harris said during the 2020 Black Girls Lead Conference. "They are burdened by only having the capacity to see what has always been instead of what can be. But don't you let that burden you." On dating her husband, Douglas Emhoff, she says, "As a single professional woman in my 40s and very much in the public eye, dating wasn't easy." Harris, who is now married to Douglas Emhoff, wrote in her 2019 memoir, The Truths We Hold, "I knew that if I brought a man with me to an event, people would immediately start to speculate about our relationship. I also knew that single women in politics are viewed differently than single men. We don't get the same latitude when it comes to our social lives." On making tough decisions. "I'm a career prosecutor," Harris told the New York Times. "I have been trained, and my experience over decades is to make decisions after a review of the evidence and the facts, and not to jump up with grand gestures before I've done that. Some might interpret that as being cautious. I would tell you that's just responsible." On speaking up. "What I want young women and girls to know is this. You are powerful, and your voice matters," Harris told Marie Claire. "You're going to walk into many rooms in your life and career where you may be the only one who looks like you or who has had the experiences that you have had. But you remember that when you're in those rooms, you are not alone. We are all in that room with you, applauding you on, cheering your voice, and just so proud of you. So you use that voice and be strong." On attending Howard University. "I became an adult at Howard University," Harris told the Washington Post. "Howard very directly influenced and reinforced, equally important, my sense of being and meaning and reasons for being." On being Mamala. "I've had a lot of titles over my career, and certainly vice president will be great. But Mamala will always be the one that means the most." That's what Harris said after being named the Democratic nominee for vice president. And finally, on America's racial reckoning, she says, "But now, because of the smartphone, America and the world are seeing in vivid detail the brutality that communities have known for generations," Harris said in an interview with the New York Times. "You can't deny. You can't look away. It's there. I do believe people are seeing the injustice of it all and are prepared to take action in a way that we've not seen before. And that does give me hope." Okay. Will saying rabbit, rabbit on the first of the month really bring me luck? Of course we can't say for sure, but it couldn't hurt. There's a photograph showing two bunny rabbits rubbing their noses together. Is there a dream job you're trying to land? You getting ready to ask for a raise? Have a first date and really want it to go well? Or are you just wishing for that extra bit of luck so things go your way? Instead of merely crossing your fingers, according to a popular superstition, if rabbit rabbit or white rabbits or some other variation of the word rabbit are the initial words that cross your lips on the first of the month, the following 30-ish days will be full of good fortune, according to lore. The question is why? We've gotten to the bottom of the true meaning and history of rabbit rabbit, so you can decide for yourself if it's a tradition you want to adopt. While we can't pinpoint the precise origin of saying rabbit rabbit on the first of the month, there are several reasons why rabbits are often thought of as good omens and invoked in the name of luck. Rabbits have been considered a symbol of fortune for over 2,000 years, according to NPR. For example, a rabbit's foot has historically been considered a lucky omen. In addition, these prolific procreators are also an ancient symbol of fertility and life, as well as a religious symbol of spring and renewal. But it wasn't until the early 1900s that we first saw a written reference to the superstition. In a 1909 issue of the British journal Notes and Queries, a parent observed that children would say rabbits on the first of the month for good luck, according to the History Channel. It's also been used by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Nottingham Evening Post reported in November 1935. Even Mr. Roosevelt, the President of the United States, has confessed to a friend that he says rabbits on the first of every month, and what is more, he would not think of omitting the utterance on any account. More recently, the tradition has been kept alive and well by shows like Nick Days by Nickelodeon, as well as actress Sarah Jessica Parker, who consistently has posted Rabbit Rabbit on Instagram on the first day of the month and collaborated with Gap Kids on a 2018 clothing line that features the phrase Rabbit Rabbit on jackets. How does it work, and how many times do you say rabbit? Are you willing to give it a try, but you're just not sure of the guidelines? Like many superstitions, there are slight variations in methods and how many times to say the word rabbit. For example, in a book published in 1922 titled Solomon and All His Glory, the author wrote, "If you say rabbit, rabbit, rabbit 3 times, just like that, first thing in the morning on the first of the month, even before you say your prayers, you'll get a present before the end of the month." Others use a different phrase. In an op-ed for the New York Times, British-American writer Simon Winchester noted, "Ever since I was 4 years old, I have said white rabbits at the very moment of waking on every single day of every single month that has passed." Or learn from actress Sarah Jessica Parker, who has been dedicated to the rabbit rabbit superstition for upwards of 25 years. Parker told InStyle, "There are 2 options. You can stay awake until midnight of the last night of the month. Wait until 12:01 and then say rabbit 2 times. Or you can also choose to sleep before midnight, but when you wake up on the first of the month, before you say another word to anybody else, anybody, you must say rabbit rabbit." According to Parker, this method works just as well. If you forgot to say rabbit rabbit on the first of the month, but you still want to give it a try, you're in luck. According to word historian Martha Barnett, you can say tibar tibar, which is rabbit rabbit spelled backwards, and still be in the clear. All right, this next article is called Barack Obama's Introspective Memoir, A Promised Land, offers a revealing look at his presidency. A Promised Land, President Obama's hotly anticipated new memoir, arrives today in bookstores in more than 50 countries around the world. It's already been translated into 26 languages, a rare simultaneous global publishing event. A total of 3.4 million copies have already been shipped to retailers in the United States and Canada alone. A Promised Land takes readers behind the scenes of the 44th U.S. president's decision to run for office, a process that was far from a straight line. For most of his teenage years in Hawaii, Obama writes, he was not a budding leader, but rather a lackadaisical student, a passionate basketball player of limited talent, and incessant, dedicated partier. No student government for me, no Eagle Scouts or interning at the local congressman's office. Through high school, my friends and I didn't discuss much beyond sports, girls, music, and plans for getting loaded. But midway through prep school, young Barry Obama discovered literature, works by the likes of Ralph Ellison, Langston Hughes, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Dostoevsky. He began to acquire so many books that his grandfather asked if he was planning to open a library. It was also around this time that Obama began asking questions about his father and about race. By the time he arrived at Occidental College a few years later, in 1979, he had at least a thin but passable knowledge of political issues and a series of half-baked opinions that I'd toss out during late-night bull sessions in the dorm. By his sophomore year, ambition kicked in. Obama transferred to Columbia University, eventually going on to Harvard Law School, where he became the first Black editor of the Law Review. But, he writes, it was moving to Chicago in 1983 that changed the arc of his life. Obama moved there after graduating from Columbia and began community organizing before returning to the East Coast to attend Harvard Law. It was when he returned to Chicago for a summer internship that he met Michelle LaVon Robinson and began to fall in love both with her and with the idea of politics. Michelle, he writes, was an original. I knew nobody quite like her. He goes on to explain how the pair became friends as well as lovers. After they wed, Obama went from community organizing to becoming a candidate for Illinois State Senate, a seat he won, though his frequent absences strained their then-young marriage. He later entered the Democratic primary, running for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, but lost by a whopping 30 percentage points. And yet his urge to run for national office didn't ebb. What he was after, Obama writes, was a politics that bridged America's racial, ethnic, and religious divides, as well as the many strands of my own life. Though, he writes, when I think back now on the brashness, the sheer chutzpah of me wanting to launch a U.S. Senate race, fresh as I was, off a resounding defeat, it's hard not to admit the possibility that I was just desperate for another shot, like an alcoholic rationalizing one last drink. But he concluded that this wasn't actually how he felt at the time. Instead, he felt a great clarity that I could win, and if I did win, I could have a big impact. Despite the continuing sacrifices that Obama's ambitions had on his young family, by then they'd had Sasha and Malia, and his untraditional background, and Obama's own speculation that his childhood friends were thinking about him. That guy? How the hell did that happen? At this point in a promised land, Obama's astonishing ascent begins to seem inevitable. His temperament, vision for America, and ability to embody that vision combine to propel him into the world's most important office. In the 700-plus pages of the book that unfold, moment by moment, decision by decision, we get to know how President and Mrs. Obama and their trusted advisors built their platform voter by voter, and passed monumental legislation such as the ACA inch by inch. Readers even get taken inside the Situation Room to witness the killing of Osama bin Laden, which is where this memoir concludes. What nagged President Obama then, he writes, was that unity of effort, that sense of common purpose, possible only when the goal involved in killing a terrorist? For all the pride and satisfaction I took in the success of our mission, the truth is, I hadn't felt the same exuberance as I had on the night the health care bill passed. I found myself imagining what America might look like if we could rally the country so that our government brought the same level of expertise and determination to educating children or housing the homeless, and how much work I had left to do. A Promised Land is remarkable for its precision and thoroughness, as well as for its honesty, humor, and thoughtful perspective. President Obama's skill as a writer and his generosity in sharing his doubts and disappointments, as well as his accomplishments and convictions, make the memoir a must-read for all those who wonder why character matters and what true patriotism looks like. And for political junkies, there are nuggets on each and every page. Okay, this next article is called How My Dead Husband's Clothes Helped Me Cope 5 Years After His Suicide. In the wake of her husband's death, writer Rachel Zimmerman finds unexpected comfort in the laundry basket. 5 years after my husband's suicide, I am folding his laundry. From a large basket, I pull out the soft black and white t-shirts he wore to play Ultimate Frisbee on Tuesday nights. After the game, the guys would grill burgers, smoke a little pot, and share the injustices of middle age. They'd been playing together for more than 20 years, through births and divorces, blockbuster ideas that never panned out, injuries to the body and mind. His shorts are here too, nearly a dozen pairs in different earth tones. If they came from a stylish catalog, they'd be sandstone, red rock, brushed camel. But Seth was an engineer, not fancy. He'd call them yellow, red, brown, and his socks, a sad collection of white anklets, released after 5 years spent stashed in a plastic bag. Shortly after he died, I asked my children's longtime babysitter if she could clear his belongings from the bathroom. The expired prescription medicines, shaving cream, and contact lens solution were painful jabs, each deepening the ache of a death no one could fathom. But his clothes posed a different dilemma. I couldn't bear to look at the maroon windbreaker that still held the shape of his broad shoulders, or the dark suit he married me in, but I couldn't part with them either. Everything got stuffed into garbage bags and piled on his basement workbench, where, under the dim light of a dangling bulb, he'd tinker with broken appliances and repair the clasp on little girls' necklaces. When he emerged, triumphantly holding up the restored jewelry, he'd tell the children, "I can fix anything but a broken heart." We believed him. I didn't think about the clothes I'd banished to the basement until the summer before last, when my older daughter, then 16, asked to visit that house which I'd been renting to a family friend because I couldn't face selling it. At first, I say no. I want to protect her from the house and its objects, which to me remain frozen in time, haunted, chaotic. We moved out haphazardly when my daughters were small, turning our back on a life that had been upended. We packed what we needed, like evacuees rushing to beat an impending storm, and left the rest. But my impulsive no melts into an empathetic, yes, of course. This is healthy, resilience in action, a way for my daughter to hold that chapter of her life intact. To her, the abandoned clothes are not markers of death. They're a fashion statement. She is eager to thrift amid his treasure trove. She spends several hours in the damp basement, ripping open garbage bags, sorting piles. Afterwards, she calls me, elated. "Such cool shirts," she says, "and some jeans. I can make them work." Several weeks later, when my younger daughter returns from sleepaway camp, she wants a piece of the action. With two daughters, the illusion of parity is vital for peacekeeping. So I drive her to the old house, and she heads straight downstairs. Carefully unfolding each item, she deploys an analytical evaluation that takes into account many factors. Memories evoked, coolness, and the sheer desire to surpass her sister's loot. Of course she wants the Crazy Cat and Spider-Man tees, and the one featuring Malou, the wire fox terrier from Tintin. But she also goes for the entire bag of socks. I see no hip factor in those, or the many faded shirts from the computer science and artificial intelligence lab at MIT, where Seth was a professor and researcher for 2 decades. I sit on the splintered basement steps, fighting my own sense of remorse, the stain of injustice that marks this house, these objects. Why him? Why us? It takes effort to breathe. My daughter holds up a shirt, and I imagine our simultaneous memory of her father's muscular arms emerging from the now lifeless sleeves. She wraps a pair of shorts around her waist and swishes her hips, and the movement rekindles the way Seth would burst into a sprint down the field to catch a frisbee. To her, the abandoned clothes are not markers of death. They're a fashion statement. But I want out, away from this basement. I've moved on, as my friends say, finding new love and setting up a house in a brighter space with a dry basement and an abundant garden I can walk through barefoot, snipping parsley and basil and sweet yellow tomatoes. Down here, I face stagnation, ghost, a man pledged to me but no longer mine. There would be no more Saturday mornings when we'd sneak back to bed, the kids downstairs glued to a movie and sated by bowls of warm, sweet oats. My deep mourning for the life we'd built had until now been dormant, like an old coat of lead paint that is safe until a child chips away the edges, exposing its toxicity. It's different for my daughter. When I'm able to pry myself loose from personal sorrow, I think two thoughts at the same time. Why didn't I throw this crap out? And also, oh, how wonderful that I didn't. We heave 4 30-gallon bags of clothes up the stairs and into the car. When we get home, the kids trade and compare items like it's Halloween and they're negotiating Charleston chews and Kit Kats. They begin to pull shirts over their heads, but I stop them. Everything's been sitting in stale air for years and needs to be washed. There are so many clothes that we all take a basket, and the ritual of washing and folding and storing extends over weeks. Gradually, the clothes insinuate themselves into the daily rotation. Sometimes the shirts become nightgowns, billowing down to the girls' knees. Soon I even notice more of Seth hanging around, the nylon sports pants he threw on when shoveling snow from our front yard, the jacket he wore when he took the girls to see Atlas, the humanoid robot he and his students were engineering into a reliable emergency worker. All of Seth's clothes were loose and comfortable. And I start to think that they formed a deliberate costume, a casual exterior masking the tightening grip inside his brain. 2 months later, on the first day of eighth grade, my younger daughter, compact and muscular like Seth, wears his crazy cat shirt. I wave goodbye as she walks to school, buzzing and excited. Cold air has set in, and the transition to fall, so destabilizing for the past 5 years, seems particularly harsh now, rife with contradictions. September was when Seth and I got married, when the promise of home and family seemed rich and certain. September was also when I first explained the word suicide to my children, when they had to answer questions from friends. Where's your dad? And when we returned to a world that for us had been violently altered. It's late morning. I search my drawers for a pair of running socks. Finding none, I enter my daughter's room where Seth's socks lay in a heap. They're threadbare, and most have lost their elasticity. I could trash them, and no one would notice. Instead, I sit on the floor and slide them over my toes. I head out toward the river. Settling into a comfortable stride, I imagine Seth cushioning each step, invisibly present, a thin veneer of what remains. All right, this next article is called Matthew McConaughey and His Mom Open Up About Their Estrangement on Red Table Talk. Matthew McConaughey and his mom, Kay, made a memorable appearance on the most recent episode of Red Table Talk, hosted by three generations of powerhouses, Jada Pinkett Smith, Willow Smith, and Adrienne Banfield Norris. Kay, now 88, is spending the quarantine in Texas with McConaughey and his wife, Camila Alves, and their three children, Levi, 12, Vita, 10, and Livingston, 7. It's been really lovely. I'm enjoying being around my grandchildren. Matthew is a very good son. I'm going to give myself some credit for raising him right, Kay said. She added that she treats her grandchildren the same way she treated her sons, Matthew and his older brother, Mike Rooster McConaughey. If they smart off to me, it does not turn out well, she said, laughing. Though the interstellar star and his mom are the picture of domestic tranquility right now, it wasn't always the case. If you've read Matthew McConaughey's new memoir, Green Lights, then you know that there are things from his past that merit a trip to the red table, especially regarding his upbringing. The book opens with a vivid scene of McConaughey's parents physically fighting in front of 5-year-old Matthew, and then getting frisky. The scene encapsulates McConaughey's volatile relationship. Kay and her husband, James, were married 3 times and divorced 2x, all to each other. In 1992, James died while making love to Kay. His heart just stopped, you know? We had a party for him, kind of a celebration of life, Kay said. 4 years after her husband died, Kay and her son hit a low point in their relationship. The trouble began after McConaughey made 1996's A Time to Kill and got famous. According to McConaughey, Kay struggled with the transition to having a prominent son. Translation? She was speaking to the press. After their weekly Sunday phone calls, Kay would feed information about his private life to news outlets. Mother wasn't answering the phone. A fan of my fame was answering the phone. I was trying to find my own balance with fame and stuff, and I would share things with her. Some of the things I would share might show up in the 6 o'clock news 3 days later, he said. At one point, Hard Copy, a tabloid TV show, came to his childhood home in Texas. McConaughey was alerted to the appearance by a friend and was shocked when he turned on the TV to find his mom giving a tour. Mom's leading the camera going, "And there's the bed where I caught him with Michelle. No big deal because she didn't last. Over here's the bathroom. Of course, I walked in on him in there and caught him doing you-know-what before. And I'm over here going, holy shit, Mom," he revealed. Reflecting on her actions today, Kay said that she was enjoying his fame more than Matthew was. As the episode played, McConaughey called to confront her. "Of course, she's watching it too, and I hear the same damn show in the background," he said. Her defense did not win him over. She goes, "I didn't think you'd find out." After that breach in privacy, McConaughey felt that he needed to distance himself from his mom. Once his career was stabilized, they rekindled their relationship. "My boat was built well enough that I didn't think she could sink it, and then I just took the reins off and said, 'Mom, hit that red carpet. Talk to all of them. Tell all the stories you want. And she's been great about it since, he said. Luckily for us, McConaughey has reached the storytelling phase of his career. With his memoir, he invites us into his extraordinary life, and perhaps tells the story he didn't want his mom saying all those years ago. Okay, this next article is called Oprah Thanks Readers of O in the magazine's last monthly issue. More than a few times in my life, God dreamed a bigger dream for me than I could have ever dreamed for myself. This magazine has been one of them. It was more than 20 years ago when two of the highest-ranking women at Hearst Publications, Kathy Black and Ellen Levine, came to visit me in Chicago and convinced me that a magazine was the written word of values, ideas, information shared multiple times over. As a teenager, I craved a subscription to 17, but never had enough money to get one. Somehow, though, I always managed to have 50 cents the day the new issue arrived at the corner store, and I always knew which day that was. I would devour every article and every picture before adding it to the stack under my bed. Reading those pages, I dreamed of my future. It was my teenage manual for living. And so, with an opportunity from Hearst I'd never even imagined, I set out to build a magazine. I had no knowledge of how to do that, just the cherished memories of what 17 had once meant to me. With O, I wanted to create a manual for living life to the fullest. Stories, photographs, reflections, poems, quotes, essays, and interviews that would bring meaning, comfort, and joy to our readers. And if I do say so myself, we have fulfilled that intention through 245 issues. When we started in 2000, no one was talking about mindfulness or wellness or spiritual well-being. 20 years later, everyone is living their best life. Today, the whole media world is scrambling to be inclusive, but O has always been. Featuring Black and Brown voices and faces, members of the LGBTQ community, bodies of all shapes and sizes, people of all ages, we've looked inward and also outward, doing deep dive stories on everything from mental health to menopause, gun violence to #MeToo, not to mention racial disparities in medicine and generational wealth and caring for aging parents. We've grown together, you and I am the better for it, having been coached by Martha Beck, Adam Glassman, and a host of other regular contributors, and every author and expert who graced our pages. I certainly never planned to be on every cover, but trying to find a different celebrity each month was not a game any of us was up for. Speaking of those covers, we intended for them to look glamorous or adventurous or just plain fun, but my, oh my, did it take a lot of effort and energy to shoot them. Covers are shipped 3 months ahead, so we were always jumping the gun on a season that hadn't even started. I remember flying to Jackson Hole to build a snowman and throw snowballs, only to have people ask later if the setting was fake. And flying to Santa Barbara because we needed a summer shot in a convertible. Turns out I owe my home to that first trip. All the beautiful trees I saw are the reason I came back later to house hunt. What I know for sure is that the chance to be in your ear and to be held in your hands, to offer you stories we thought would mean something to you, has meant everything to me. It's given my life a depth of purpose and joy to know that our words were well received, that in the most subtle and sometimes sublime ways, what we offered helped you to fulfill your best life, to dream bigger, dare greater, see things differently, love yourself more. As I look forward beyond this final monthly print edition, my intention is to continue serving up what you most need now to better your health, relationships, work life, and home life, and to reach for the dreams you still dream. Nothing stays the same, that I also know for sure. And 20 years in this format, I consider a solid run. Well done. Thank you, dear readers, for making it so. Onward to the next chapter, and you can stay tuned to oprahmag.com for everything you need to know next. So don't worry, I am reading to you from oprahmag.com, not the print edition, so we will continue to offer Oprah's content. All right, this next article is called Does Your Pet Need a Massage? While 2020 has been a doozy for us humans, it's been pretty sweet for the canine population. COVID-19 doesn't present much of a health threat for dogs. On the contrary, the pandemic has brought pups a number of benefits. Shelters are emptying out, more people are interested in fostering, and pets are getting more attention and affection, points out Heidi Cooley, a veterinarian at Banfield Pet Hospital in Vancouver, Washington. All of this newfound together time means many pet owners have become as focused on their dog's wellness as they are on their own, and are increasingly interested in non-traditional therapies to help their dogs feel as good as possible. 4 in 10 of us routinely use treatments like yoga, herbs, meditation, Reiki, and massage to cure what ails us, so why not treat our pets to the same? Experts say complementary therapies may indeed help pups of all ages, sizes, and breeds who are suffering from discomfort of the body or mind. Just be sure to check with your vet before proceeding. Veterinarians understand not only the potential benefits, but also the potential harm any alternative treatment may cause. Plus, they should be attuned to what's best for your particular dog. Treating a 6-pound geriatric with metabolic issues can be different from treating a mostly healthy 3-year-old large dog, notes Klein. If your vet isn't open to thinking outside the box, Klein suggests getting a second opinion or consulting the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association, a group of vets who advocate for the use of integrative medicine. Here are some popular alternative therapies for your 4-legged friends. Acupuncture. You get pricked to nix a nagging ache. Acupuncture is effective for neck and back pain, osteoarthritis, and frequent headaches. Your dog can go under the needle too. It's been recommended for musculoskeletal pain, arthritis, asthma, allergic dermatitis, traumatic nerve injury, and some GI and reproductive issues. It may well be worth a try. In a study following 181 dogs for up to 24 weeks, Brazilian researchers found that regular acupuncture reduced musculoskeletal pain in the vast majority of dogs. Note, are you worried about keeping your pup still while he's being poked and prodded? Dogs generally become very relaxed, most likely because of endorphin release, says Ernie Ward, founder of Dog On Healthy, a nutritional and behavioral care practice in Calabash, North Carolina. Ward says licking or pawing the needles is rare. CBD. You drop a tincture under your tongue or rub a cream on your lower back. Trendy CBD is a hot area of research and is used to self-treat everything from anxiety to chronic pain. Your dog can swallow a pet-formulated tincture or doggy treat from one of the many brands flooding the market, such as Honest Paws, Dope Dog, and Charlotte's Web. Products like these are promoted to address pet ailments like pain, anxiety, and seizures, but the scientific data on CBD use is sparse, says Tina Wismer, medical director of the ASPCA Animal Poison Control Center. Preliminary findings from a small study at Colorado State University did show that 89% of dogs with epilepsy had less frequent seizures after receiving CBD. A larger study funded by the American Kennel Club Canine Health Foundation is now underway. Note, consult your vet first. Start with a low dosage and then keep an eye on your pup. Some dogs have developed signs of toxicity after ingesting CBD products. It's difficult to tell whether they might also contain THC, which can be poisonous to animals. Call your vet immediately if you notice your pet acting lethargic or disoriented, or walking or behaving strangely. Okay, hydrotherapy. You run or exercise in a pool when your lower extremities can't handle the impact of less forgiving surfaces, or soak in a tub to relieve physical aches and psychological stress. Your dog can trot on an underwater treadmill or be held and assisted in the water to recover from an orthopedic or neurological issue. This treatment, often used in pet rehabilitation centers, is a way to help pets safely heal and build muscle strength. The warm water can also ease pain and help your dog chill out. Note, no matter how gentle this practice may seem, it could be traumatic for dogs who strongly dislike or fear water, says Cooley. Nor is hydrotherapy recommended for pets with sensitive skin open wounds, or incisions. Your best bet is to bring your pet to a rehab facility with an underwater treadmill. But if there isn't one nearby, a vet may be able to talk you through an adapted version of the treatment that involves a pool or tub. Massage. You go for a monthly session to relax your muscles and nerves. Your dog is always up for a good rubdown. A vet specializing in rehab might recommend massage to help reduce pain and improve range of motion and circulation. Note, if the therapist is too rough, the bodywork could wind up worsening an injury, warns Klein. Sensitive dogs may also react by biting the hand that needs them. Klein suggests seeking a certified canine rehabilitation practitioner or a vet who is certified by the American Veterinary Chiropractic Association. They're trained to get pets back on their paws. Okay, this next article is called Inspirational Christmas Quotes That Will Ignite the Holiday Spirit. No matter how you celebrate, these inspiring Christmas quotes and sayings will help you spread joy to your friends and family. They include short excerpts from Charles Dickens, Dr. Seuss, and Maya Angelou, funny quips that make great captions, and quotes that, above all, spread the spirit of Christmas. What would later be regarded as one of the most widely recognized staples of the Christmas season, English writer and social critic Charles Dickens published A Christmas Carol in 1843. In its original prose, it reads, "I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I will not shut out the lessons that they teach." Dr. Seuss. Children's author Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss, wrote in How the Grinch Stole Christmas, "Maybe Christmas," he thought, "doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more." Richard Paul Evans. The smells of Christmas are the smells of childhood. New York Times best-selling author Richard Paul Evans wrote in his most popular novel, The Christmas Box. English author Dorothy Coumson wrote in her 2006 novel, My Best Friend's Girl, "Christmas is a time for families." Margaret Elizabeth Sangster. Traced back to 1878, American poet and author Margaret Elizabeth Sangster wrote in her poem, The Christmas Tree, "For somehow, not only for Christmas, but all the long year through, the joy that you give to others is the joy that comes back to you." Bess Streeter Aldrich. Bess Streeter Aldrich wrote in Journey into Christmas and Other Stories, "Christmas Eve was a night of song that wrapped itself about you like a shawl, but it warmed more than your body. It warmed your heart, filled it too with melody that would last forever." Kirsten White. "Christmas Eve is my favorite. I think the anticipation is more fun than anything else. I kind of lost that. The idea that something, food, traditions, an arbitrary date on the calendar, can be special because we decide it should be. We make it special, not just for ourselves, but for others." New York Times journalist John Geddes wrote, "Freshly cut Christmas trees, smelling of stars and snow and pine resin. Inhale deeply and fill your soul with wintry night," in his book, A Familiar Rain. Carly Perrin. "It's easy to forget that life is the greatest gift of all," Carly Perrin wrote in her novel, The Gift. Max Lucado. "The magical dust of Christmas glittered on the cheeks of humanity ever so briefly, reminding us of what is worth having and what we were intended to be." Sarah Coleridge. English author and children's poet Sarah Coleridge wrote about the Christmas season in her published works, Pretty Lessons in Verse for Good Children, with some lessons in Latin and easy rhyme. "Chill December brings the sleet, blazing fire and Christmas treat." Okay, this next article is called Jason Momoa Says He and His Wife, Lisa Bonet, Are a Perfect Fit. Here's why. If it's not clear enough already, we here at OprahMag.com love a great celebrity romance, and one of the most enduring, Jason Momoa and his wife, Lisa Bonet. The Aquaman star and the Cosby Show alum have been together for over 14 years, but it turns out Momoa, 41, and Bonet, 53, were destined to meet decades before they saw each other in person, but we'll get to that later. The couple is relatively private, but they've given us enough tidbits over the years to put together a thorough timeline of their relationship, because we take journalism seriously. From their picture-perfect first meeting at a jazz club, to their blended family and ultra-private long-awaited nuptials, we've got the details on this Hollywood duo's dreamy union. In 1987, Jason Momoa first saw Lisa Bonet on his TV screen. When Momoa initially laid eyes on his future wife, it was love at first sight, but not as you might think. Along with the rest of America in the 1980s, the actor tuned in to The Cosby Show and watched Bonet star on the sitcom as Denise Huxtable, the role that launched her career. He was instantly smitten, though he was still a kid. Ever since I was like 8 years old and I saw her on the TV, I was like, "Mommy, I want that one," Momoa famously told James Corden in a 2017 episode of The Late Late Show. I'm like, "I'm gonna stalk you for the rest of my life and I am gonna get you." As we all know, the 6'4" Game of Thrones actor got his dream girl, but he didn't exactly fess up to his admiration until the pair had been together for some years. I didn't tell her that until we had two babies. Otherwise, I'd be creepy and weird. But yeah, I just always wanted to meet her. She was a queen. Always, he said to Corden. Yes, he actually called her a queen, which kind of makes up for the rest of the off-putting remarks. Momoa and Bonet's meet-cute is straight out of a rom-com. One night, mutual friends introduced the two at a New York City jazz club. Given his crush, he was understandably ecstatic. He even decided to don a matching hairstyle for the occasion. "We just happened to be in the right place at the right time," he said to Corden. "I actually had dreaded my hair for her. I had dreadlocks, she had dreadlocks." She goes, "I'm Lisa." Bonet and Momoa stopped at a cafe where they ate grits, and that was that. "We are a perfect fit," he told People magazine.
We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.